You can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Stereotyping, unlawful stereotyping, is the ultimate form of discrimination because it's evidence of discriminatory animus. The beholder's stereotype belies its bias. In the case at bar, it was Harold Lampley's rejection of the solicitation of a coworker that informed the respondents, the state, that Lampley did not exhibit his boss's stereotype of how a man should appear and behave. Mr. Lampley filed a charge of discrimination with the Commission on Human Rights based on sex and sex stereotyping because Lampley's supervisors harassed and treated him differently because of his sex, because Harold Lampley failed to conform to the sex stereotype held by his bosses. And his close friend, Renee Frost, filed a charge based upon association discrimination. But in this case, the Missouri Commission on Human Rights summarily dismissed these charges. They did not issue notices of right to sue, and the claim reason for the dismissal was that their charges were really based on sexual orientation discrimination. Now, we submit that 2 points on appeal that sex stereotyping, as alleged by Mr. Lampley, is covered under sex discrimination of the Missouri Human Rights Act, and that the Commission acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner when they handed down its decision. So we look to sex stereotyping. We're guided by regulations and federal law. First, let's just look at the regulations under the CSR by the state. The regulations are promulgated by the Commission to further aid and guidance of interpreting the Missouri Human Rights Act. And one of those regulations specifically states that stereotyping based on sex is impermissible discrimination. But the Commission ignored that regulation when they dismissed the petition, when they dismissed the charge filed by Mr. Lampley and Ms. Frost.
Isn't that regulation related to hiring practices?
Yes, that particular part of the regulation does relate to hiring practices, but we submit that it's reasonable that stereotype prohibition apply to all ranges of employment, the terms and conditions of employment, because the regulations apply to Section 213.055, and there's other regulations also promulgated by the Commission, such as regulation related to prohibition of harassment based on sex in the workplace, a prohibition based on pregnancy, and those are applied to the full range of the terms and conditions of employment. So we submit that it's reasonable that the stereotype outlined in that particular reg is also applicable to the other terms and conditions of employment. And that gets to my next point, which is that this court is guided by federal law in its decision of whether or not sex stereotyping is covered under sex discrimination. I think this court is aware that this is a case of first impression. There is no other cases in the state under the appellate level or Supreme Court that have addressed the issue of whether sex stereotyping is covered under Missouri Human Rights Act's prohibition of sex discrimination.
I believe you said there was an age stereotyping case, though?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. That was the Ferguson v. Lincoln University case. And that case by the Western District found that stereotyping based upon age is evidence of age discrimination. And similarly, we submit that stereotyping based on sex is also evidence of sex discrimination. So the earlier case that somewhat addressed this issue was the Pittman case, Pittman versus Cook Paper Recycling. In that case, the Western District held specifically that sexual orientation was not a protected class under the Missouri Human Rights Act. It did hold, though, that it did acknowledge it was not addressing sex stereotyping because that was not brought before the court. That was only squarely brought before the court by the present case at the Western District, and now it's before this court. So we look at federal law. There is a line of, and the reason why we look at federal law is because Title VII and the federal law interpreting Title VII is very similar to the Missouri Human Rights Act in that the language for Title VII, the prohibition against discrimination based upon sex, is the same as the Missouri Human Rights Act discrimination prohibition because of sex. The court is familiar with the seminal case of Price Waterhouse and the progeny of cases that have been decided since then, finding that when an employer makes a decision about an employee's employment based upon that employee's failure to conform with the sex stereotype, that is a sex-based consideration, and that is a violation of the prohibition of sex discrimination under Title VII. And the courts across the country have looked at various forms of stereotypes to which employees have not complied. For example, you have a woman who has a tomboyish appearance or uses foul language, or you have a man who dresses in pastels or bright colors, or speaks in a high-pitched voice, or uses effeminate manners, or a woman who doesn't wear a dress or makeup, or a man who does. These are gender stereotypes that have been recognized by the courts over the past years. And when an employer makes a decision about employment, about that employee, that is related to that sex stereotype, that is impermissible discrimination. So too here with the Missouri Commission on, with the Missouri Human Rights Act. In Missouri, the Missouri Human Rights Act states that when an employer, such as the Missouri Department Division of Child Support Enforcement, treats its employee, like Mr. Lampley, differently because he fails to conform with the sex stereotype, that is a sex-based consideration, and it violates the prohibition against sex discrimination under the MHRA.
Now, opposing counsel says you're really just using that as a cover. Really, it's sexual orientation discrimination here, and you're just trying to fit within the category of a different category because Missouri has not recognized sexual orientation discrimination.
Well, no, Your Honor, no, that's not true. What we're saying is that sex stereotyping is evidence of sex discrimination. We're not creating a new category. I know that respondent claims that we're saying it's sexual orientation discrimination, but the basis under Mr. Lampley's claim was sex and sex stereotyping, and the stereotyping is evidence of discrimination. The other point on appeal before this court is that the commission abused its discretion when it terminated the administrative proceedings based upon the respondent's position, the commission's position, that the charges filed by Mr. Lampley and Ms. Frost were really based on sexual orientation discrimination. We submit that decision by the commission was arbitrary and capricious. First, the commission ignored the plain language of the charge. It ignored the fact that Mr. Lampley checked the box that said sex, and in the particulars of his charge where he described what happened, he stated that he was treated differently because of his sex and because he failed to comport with the stereotype of how a man should appear and behave. The commission completely ignored that language and just decided to label it sexual orientation. Second, the commission conducted no investigation at all. It just summarily dismissed the case. It didn't even look the charge, excuse me. It didn't even conduct an investigation to see what the basis of why Mr. Lampley checked the box for sex or why he alleged sex stereotyping. They conducted no investigation at all. And third, it's important to note that the commission's decision to dismiss based upon the alleged sexual orientation of Mr. Lampley, or that was the basis for the charge, this decision by the commission was rendered many months before the Pittman decision, in which the court held sexual orientation was not a separate class under the Missouri Human Rights Act. Now, the only direction that the commission had at this time was the Missouri Human Rights Act and the regulations. And the regulations that specify sex discrimination. So based upon those items, we submit that the decision of the commission was arbitrary and capricious. Now, in addition, respondents claim that Mr. Lampley should have added more details to his charge. He should have had more information so they can understand really what the sex stereotyping basis was. Well, charges are not fact pleading. Charges are notice. And there is no statute, regulation, or case law that says otherwise. All Mr. Lampley had to do was provide notice to the respondent, here in the state, that he believes he's discriminated against based upon his sex and sex stereotyping. Now, and that's one of the reasons why charges of discrimination are first looked at in an administrative context. It's to give notice to the other side and offer an opportunity for conciliation or settlement before it gets to a pleading stage. But that's not what happened here. The commission conducted no investigation, and doesn't even appear that the commission read the charge. In addition, the respondents claim that the court should look to the legislative history of the Missouri Human Rights Act to aid in its reaching its decision today. And for two reasons, there's no need for the court to look at legislative inaction. First, the only time the court should look to legislative action is if the statute's unclear if it's confusing. But the Missouri Human Rights Act could not use language that was more plain and more direct, prohibiting discrimination because of sex. There's no ambiguity. The act is clear. Second, legislative inaction can be interpreted and should be interpreted to mean there was no need to change the statutory language. Sex discrimination covered it all. There's no need to add any details, just as there's no need to modify the sex discrimination prohibition to allow for sex harassment in the workplace, hostile work environment, or pregnancy. There was no need to do that, or sex stereotyping, as we submit. There's no need to revise the statute. Finally, respondents address and claim, as Justice mentioned, that the basis for Mr. Lampley's claim was really based on sexual orientation. Again, the basis of the charge has been sex discrimination. And we submit that if the court wants to address that and wants to discuss it here, we submit that evidence of discrimination based upon sexual orientation is sex discrimination. And that's because who a person should love is a sex stereotype. We talked earlier about discriminating based upon non-conforming with other gender stereotypes, such that we talked about earlier. And another stereotype is who a person should partner with. The stereotype is that a man should only partner with a woman, and a woman should only partner with a man. But someone's sexual orientation, when they choose to partner with somebody of the same sex, that violates that notion of a sex stereotype of who an individual should partner with or who an individual should associate with. And that decision, if it's based upon sexual orientation, is based upon sex, because you're looking at the sex of who the individual, the employee, is choosing to partner with or to marry. And I took two respondents for there.
Thank you.
May it please the court. This court need only decide one extremely narrow question, whether the charge in this case alleged enough particulars, as required by statute, to make out a prima facie case of sex discrimination. Opposing counsel asked this court to adopt a sex stereotyping theory, but they have not alleged that Mr. Lampley failed to meet any sex stereotypes other than the fact that he was gay. Mr. Lampley has not alleged that he dresses differently from other men, that he wears his hair differently, that he's effeminate, or anything else. The only
Has any investigation been done here?
No. The only thing that he has alleged at all is that he is gay. But if that is enough,
he alleged he was discriminated against based on sex stereotyping too, also.
He stated as a bald, conclusory legal statement that he was discriminated on the basis of sex stereotypes. And I think it's really important to look at the charge in this case for exactly what it says. It says, quote, my supervisors harass me because I am gay and do not exhibit the stereotypical attributes of how a man should appear or behave.
But what's the letter allege? That second part alleges that he doesn't display the characteristics that a man would be expected to behave, to show, and therefore he was harassed.
No, that is a legal statement. It is not a factual particular pleading. And the statute requires factual particulars. It's not enough to state that you intend to have a legal theory of one kind or another. You have got to state factual particulars.
And where
by
is
statute.
That in the Missouri Human Rights Act? It requires that?
That's in the statute governing the commission. That is section 213.075, which says that if you want to raise a complaint, you have to, quote, state the name and address of the person alleged to have committed the unlawful discriminatory practice, and, quote, set forth the particulars thereof and such other information as may be required by the commission. As this court held in Farrow, this is necessary so that the commission can examine its jurisdiction and dismiss complaints that are not covered under the act. This is very important language. It talks about the particulars of the case. That requires specific factual allegations. And here, it's not simply enough to check the sex discrimination box or to say the elements of sex discrimination are met in this case, which is what his complaint tried to do.
Is there case law that
interpret, set forth the particulars thereof to be require some level of factual allegations?
The best case is the Farrow case, discussed in our briefs. And that one says that the purpose of this provision is to put the employer on reasonable notice of each specific of the claim of discrimination. And then it also says that the employee cannot rely on facts that they don't put into their charge. And here they did not put facts into their charge of anything other than the fact that he was gay. Nor did they allege that any discrimination was made between men and women. Instead, he said there was discrimination between gay and non-gay employees.
I know you rely on that. You rely on the Court of Appeals relied on the Johnson case, I think, in the earlier case, a similar thing. Where's this between men and women? How does Price Waterhouse fit into that?
Right, and I think it's very important to look at Price Waterhouse in terms of what it was trying to remedy in terms of discrimination. It was confronting the classic situation of sex discrimination that courts and legislators across this country had in mind, which is women being treated poorly in the workplace compared to men. And in that situation, they said the legal claim, was that a woman was being discriminated against on the basis of sex, being treated unfairly compared to men. And then they talked about evidentiary questions about how do you have circumstantial evidence of the intent for that differential treatment of employees. And they said one piece of evidence that might be relevant to help put bricks together to build a case might be statements from the employer that says, I'm not promoting her because, you know, in essence, she's not pretty enough. Well, it's very reasonable to look at the situation and say, look, that plus other facts might say, it's not that you're not promoting her because she's not pretty enough. You promoted every man. What you're really doing is just wanting to treat her badly because of her sex. That's the right understanding of Price Waterhouse.
And, of course, we've applied it to males, too. You can discriminate against men, so it can't be to correct the historical, only to correct the historical discrimination against women, because discrimination against men in the workplace is also prohibited, isn't that right?
Absolutely, and that's because of the text of the law says it's on the basis of sex.
But if we look at the actual words that the legislature used, as Justice Scalia said, non-kel, not at the particular evil they may have had in mind in enacting the statute. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. And Justice Scalia was exactly right in that case because he talked about the original public meaning of the words chosen to be used in the statute. And the statute didn't say, oh, you can't treat women worse. They said no one can be treated worse on the basis of sex. So even if the primary evil was women, the legislature chose words they knew would allow men to bring sex discrimination claims as well as women.
And what if you're gay? Can you bring a sex discrimination claim if you're discriminated against based upon the characteristics you display in the workplace, if you're perceived as effeminate or perceived if you're a woman, if you're perceived in the way the woman was in Price Waterhouse? Does the fact that you're gay have any effect on whether or not you can bring that claim?
So I think it's important, again, to stick with the text here. And what the text says is that both men and women can bring claims of sex discrimination, of course. And then what you look at in Price Waterhouse is evidence to prove out the prima facie elements of a sex discrimination claim. This case is about the fourth element, whether you have discriminatory treatment of men versus women. And sex stereotyping is evidence.
But my question is, are you saying Price Waterhouse only applies to straight people? Or can gay people also bring claims of discrimination based on sex stereotyping?
We're saying they can bring claims based on sex. Sex stereotyping
and sexual... Sex stereotyping is evidence of discrimination based on sex.
Yes, but it's very important to understand that sex stereotyping is not an independent theory of liability.
It's evidence of discrimination based on sex, and can both gay and straight people bring that claim?
They can, but it's very important to understand that the basis of the claim has to be that the employer treated men worse than women, not...
And where do you get that?
Because that's the longstanding interpretation of the meaning of sex. That's a plain, ordinary, usual meaning of sex that this court has used in every case until this point. That the element
is that the interpretation all the federal courts have applied, and even ones who don't recognize sexual orientation discrimination do recognize sex stereotyping discrimination. They distinguish between those.
So over the 5 decades since the Civil Rights Act was enacted in 1964, the great weight of federal authority has stuck with not recognizing as an independent theory of liability sex stereotyping or sexual orientation. The current split is 11-2 because in the last year, 2 circuit courts have abandoned this under a theory of abandoning the public meaning and text of the statute to allow theories of liability under sex stereotyping and sexual orientation as such. Instead, they should have stuck with the other 11 circuits that the federal courts have considered.
I think you're talking about sexual orientation cases where there are two, but there's a lot more that bar sexual stereotype, that allow you to use sexual stereotyping to prove a case of sex discrimination. Fourth Circuit, Sixth Circuit, which you rely on so much in orientation, permits you to bring stereotyping cases.
That is incorrect. Those cases talk about evidence. They do not talk about sex stereotyping as an independent theory of liability. They talk about sex stereotyping as evidence to show that a man was treated worse than a woman in the workplace. And that's really important because it talks about the substantive prohibitions about what an employer can or can't do. What the employer can't do is say, look, I just don't want to promote one sex, or I don't want to hire one sex, or I'm just going to harass one sex. But that doesn't talk about distinctions among people of those sexes. And that's where the evidentiary distinction comes into play, because it affects the substantive obligations on the employers.
We actually do bar pregnancy discrimination, which is among women. So we do allow you to bring claims saying you're discriminated against where other women weren't because of a characteristic, being pregnant, for instance.
So I think the Mid-State Oil case, what you talked about in that case as well, was evidence of discrimination. And it wasn't that pregnancy was written into the act itself, but what it said was when you have an employer who says, I love everybody, I want to hire everyone, I'm going to promote all the men, I'm just not promoting anyone who happens to be pregnant. Obviously, in that case, that can be evidence to suggest that what the employer has in mind is treating women worse than men on the basis of their sex. That's why it's considered sex discrimination. Here what you have is not an employer whose motivation is sex. The motivation is sexual orientation, which the public, ordinary people of regular understanding would not consider to be part of sex discrimination. The long-standing understanding of these terms is totally different than the Missouri Human Rights Act would cover sexual orientation discrimination.
Thank you.
Again, I think it's extremely important to look at the charge in this case and understand exactly what it says. If a charge includes enough particulars under a particularity requirement to provide the facts of the charge, only saying that you were harassed for being gay and thus didn't meet the stereotypical attributes of men, if that is enough to make out a sex stereotyping claim, all you have to do is say you were harassed because you were gay and check a box for sex discrimination, then the act essentially prohibits sexual orientation discrimination. And we know from the plain and ordinary meaning of the act, understood by common people of ordinary intelligence in the usual sense, that it was meant since 1965, that the act does not encompass sexual orientation discrimination. It's the same reason it doesn't encompass discrimination on the basis of gender identity or other traits. It only encompasses sex discrimination. All of these other traits might be evidence of whether a man was treated worse than a woman. But the question is not whether women were treated worse than other women. The question is whether women were treated worse than men, or vice versa in the case of when a man brings a claim. And this distinction is important because that's the textual limits of this act. And were this court to go beyond the public meaning of this act, as Judge Posner has, as the Seventh Circuit in Zarda has, you would be abandoning the public meaning of the act and going beyond someone would anticipate in the meaning of the act. It's really important for the public to have notice of what their obligations are under the Human Rights Act, what is considered discrimination and not discrimination. And no person of ordinary intelligence in a small business with maybe six employees, which would be covered by the act, would have read this act at any time in the past to encompass a claim where if someone says they're harassed because they're gay, that's enough, that's a stereotype, that's neglect, sex discrimination.
And does your argument depend on our interpreting the claim that's brought in that way? Because you seem to keep moving everything into treating this as a sexual orientation claim and then say that can't, that has not been recognized.
No, even if you take it strictly as a sex stereotyping claim, it does not allege enough particulars to make out a sex stereotyping claim. And that was the first point I was trying to get at. It doesn't say that he has other sex stereotypes that he fails to meet in the workplace, such as an effeminate manner of dress or behavior or anything like that. There are no particular facts alleged on those points, which were his burden to put on a charge at this point. And he amended his charge to include other factual allegations, but did not amend the charge to include allegations of this point. And as the federal courts have held, where you only have a charge of sexual orientation as the basis for failure to comply with sex stereotypes, that alone is not enough. In fact, as Judge Pryor said in his 11th Circuit concurrence in Evans just this last year, if you look at it and say, oh, because he's gay, he must fail to conform to sex stereotypes, that in fact is imposing a sex stereotype on the man himself. Because you can't assume that just because someone is gay, that they would have other attributes in which they fail to conform to sex stereotypes. And here, it's simply not enough to make out a charge. And the important thing, again, is to step back and look at the employer's motivation here. Is the employer's motivation sex, or is the employer's motivation sexual orientation? Sexual orientation can apply to both sexes, which is why it's not inherently sex discrimination. As the dissenting opinion in the Hively case in the Seventh Circuit point out from Judge Sykes, that's really the distinct line. That's why the text matters, because of sex or because of sexual orientation. And that's how we have the difference here.
Haven't some courts, though, looked at the question of whether the plaintiff would have suffered the same action if they were the opposite sex?
Right, and Judge Sykes really deals with that well in her opinion in that case. So what you have to do is, if you hold everything constant and compare them, that can be an evidentiary method of proof to decide whether a claim is made out because of sex. So, for example, if an employer says, I am biased, you know, let's assume an employer is speaking frankly. I disagree with sexual orientations that are not straight, and the employer harasses gay men and lesbian women. That is sexual orientation discrimination. The employer harasses gay men but not lesbian women, I think then you not only have sexual orientation discrimination, then you have sex discrimination.
I'm looking at the Farrell case that you said required factual pleading, and that no facts could be considered that were not mentioned, that there was that requirement. And it says, administrative complaints are interpreted liberally in an effort to further the remedial purposes of legislation that prohibits unlawful employment practices. As a result, administrative remedies are deemed exhausted as to all incidents of discrimination that are likely or reasonably related to the allegations of the charge, and it mentions it's a notice of the allegations. And the ruling, unless I'm missing it's on some other point, the ruling was that she didn't make a claim for retaliation because all of her claims of discrimination related to prior to her being terminated. So is there some other portion of the case that says you must plead facts?
So I'm happy to expound on this further, and yeah, our briefs have this in full. The Farrell case is a leading one because it talks about the purpose of the statute to put it on notice. The best case where this court has examined what you actually need to put in a charge is the Hill case that we also cite in our briefs. And then the Eastern District also has a helpful opinion on this point in the Missouri Department of Natural Resources point. And the broader point here to understand is the purpose of putting people on notice is why you have the statutory text that says you must have the particulars of the claim. And to be sure, you don't require everyone to have a lawyer when they're writing their charge. But the statute does require the particulars of the claim as opposed to only the legal theory on which they want to proceed.
It seems to me that Farrell interprets it very expansively as to anything that could fall within the nature of the claim. So that even seems contrary to your argument.
If Farrell is taken too far for a liberal pleading standard here, it will be in conflict with the Act's statutory requirement that there be particulars. It wasn't taken that far in Farrell because it held that the particulars were not made out. But were this court to follow the decision of the Court of Appeals below and to interpret it this liberally, it will read out the particularity requirement in the statute, and that this court cannot do but under the statute. And so there has to be a limit to just how loose a complaint can be. The purpose of it still has to have factual allegations that would make out the case of sex discrimination. You can't just skip a major element of the claim by not having any facts that would go to that point. And here, if I realize my time is up.
I was waiting for you to look this direction. Thank you.
Jews are cheap, old people are slow, blacks are lazy. Hearing these stereotypes makes you cringe. Why? Because they are offensive, they reinforce prejudice, and they are evidence of discrimination. And that's what we have here with sex stereotypes. Stereotyping is evidence of discrimination, and that is what we have in this case. When an employer makes a decision based upon a stereotype, whether it's age, as in the Ferguson case, or here based upon the sex stereotype of Mr. Lampley, That is a sex-based consideration, and it is evidence of sex discrimination. We are not asking for a separate or freestanding cause of action based upon sex stereotyping. Stereotyping is evidence of discrimination. And in Pricewaterhouse, the court acknowledged and held that when you stereotype, make decisions about an employee because she doesn't wear makeup or because she uses foul language, that is a sex-based consideration. There is no need to have a comparison. There's no need to compare, well, they're not treating men differently than they are women, so there's no discrimination. The comparator is just another way of proving discriminatory intent, just like you can look at other people in the same category who are treated the same, like as you have Me Too evidence, as we discussed this in the Cox case. So a comparator between a man and a woman is just one way of establishing sex discrimination. We have sex stereotyping, we have harassment at work, and even going as far as the allegation that that if someone makes a decision about someone's employment based upon their sexual orientation status, that too is a sex-based consideration. You can't do anything to remove sex from that characteristic. It is a sex-based consideration. And it's illegal under the Missouri Human Rights Act under the prohibition of sex discrimination. Now, I also want to address respondents' claims that we have to fact plead the charge. That is not the case in Missouri. The purpose of a charge is notice. We noticed it in the Hill case, in the Farrell case. It is, and the charges are to be read liberally.
How does one give meaning to the word particularity?
Well, it is part of the story. What can aid the commission when they're conducting an investigation to decide if they have jurisdiction and if there's a claim? So, and that it's particulars is not defined in the statute, and even in the charge form that Mr. Lampley filled out in this case, there is even no statement that says these are particulars. It's just a box that he filled in his story. So it was enough to claim sex. It was enough to claim sex stereotyping just as Mr. Lampley put in his address, his date of birth. Those were information that the commission needed to see if they had jurisdiction. Now, Mr. Lampley is under 40 if you look at his charge. And so in his charge, he's under 40, he wouldn't qualify for an age discrimination claim because under the act, plainly it applies to people who are 40 and up to the age of 70. So that wouldn't apply here. And to address the judge's other question, just because Mr. Lampley may be gay doesn't mean he's not entitled to the protections under the Missouri Human Rights Act for prohibition against sex discrimination. So just because he may be gay or someone may be lesbian doesn't mean that they're not entitled to the prohibition of sex discrimination under the Act. So getting to the specificity that's insisted by respondents, that is just not true. That's not the law. You only have to provide enough information to provide notice to the commission, and the commission, looking at that, should have said, you checked the box sex, I see sex stereotyping in there that matches what's in our regulation that prohibits stereotyping based on sex, and we're going to investigate it. If they had investigated, we don't have a record here, they may have found out other reasons why his bosses thought that Mr. Lampley didn't comport with their stereotype of how a man should appear and behave.
Thank you, Counselor. It was a well-argued case on both sides.